So just to see if people can hear me without the microphone, is that good or not? No, I heard some no's, so I'm going to go up here. I have a tendency to be too loud, so if you can't hear me, just raise your hand anytime during the talk if I start to wander too much. So it's a great honor to be able to talk today about natural history, ecology, and the Anthropocene, and to be able to speak in behalf of the natural history section, which I think is a tremendously relevant and timely section for ESA on its 5-year anniversary. Congratulations, Natural History Section. And to the centennial of ESA on its 100-year anniversary, and a huge congratulations there, of course. And it's an honor to be a part of such a great tribe. And I think this afternoon is where so much, I think the symposium this afternoon is where so many speakers will be digging into both the history and the currency of natural history and its relevancy to ecology. And I encourage folks to go to those talks. They will be much deeper into the meat of actual natural history stories than I will be doing today. I want to talk explicitly about what natural history and what ecology, what it will look like as we move into the Anthropocene. And I want to pick up on some of the themes from the open plenary lecture. And I do that because I spent the last 2.5 years really working in an international institution trying to build science within an advocacy organization, trying to understand how science gets from discovery communities and into action communities. And so some of my talk is around that process. I think that's entirely relevant and crucial for natural history, and natural history is a part of that, but it's equally crucial for ecology as a field that includes natural history. But this idea of the Anthropocene has been discussed by a number of folks already today, and I want to sort of put it back into context a little bit, because while a lot of folks, when they're talking about the Anthropocene and the human footprint on the planet, are focused on the challenges that our human population presents, whether it's building cities where we're adding a 250,000 people every day to cities around the world, and we'll be doing that for 30 years, whether it's ensuring energy futures for the people on this planet, food, water security, commodities, how we produce them, how we consume them, or dealing with climate change. And of course, Chris did a great job of sort of articulating the climate change issues yesterday in this very session. So these are the challenges we face. But the Anthropocene is also fundamentally a time of change for human societies, and a time of incredibly rapid change, and also rapid opportunity. I think it's important to put these worries into context, because fundamentally, there has never been a better time to be a human on this planet. And that is the Anthropocene. It is not as if, so much of the resource consumption we're doing is for naught. It is, fundamentally true that the last 100 years have seen huge sort of changes that are beneficial for humans, with a quadrupling of human population, a 17 times increase in GDP around the world. And we do this with just about doubling our net take of primary productivity on the land, going from about 17 to 25%. So we're getting more efficient at using resources for a larger human population. And if you're here, and if you were born in the last 20 years, you're of course even more lucky, right? Because in the last 20 years, there's been sort of this unprecedented increase in benefits in social and economic well-being for so many people around the planet. Whether it's a doubling of real income in low and middle income countries, a massive decline in poverty, 2 billion people getting access to drinking water, or a real declines in things like malnourishment around the world. So all of these are the celebratory statistics of the Anthropocene in some ways. And we don't sort of put the worry in that perspective to some extent, because we are always in this process of balancing human needs and the planet and the planet's sort of resources and capacities to sustain those needs. The statistics we normally talk about look a lot more like this: the fact that we're already using 50% of the terrestrial surface of the Earth. We use 54% of all the fresh water, or a bit more at this point. And with this use, with this appropriation, we're still not really meeting the basic necessities of the growing population of the planet. We've got 1 billion people without enough water, a little bit more than 1 billion people without food security. We also have 1.3 billion people lacking fundamental access to electricity. Without those three things, you're not really a part of the global society in a way that we think everyone needs to be a part of the global society. So those are the constraints on whatever solutions we put forward. And in the open plenary, a lot of people did speak about population. And I put three lines up here because We don't know where population's going to level off. But I think in that plenary session, Dave Tillman did a good job of sort of making the point that while the variance and the uncertainty in population growth is large and the increase is significant and will have big impacts on the planet, the reason that most of us are really worried about the feedback of planetary feedbacks turning from a grumble or a rumble in the background to a roar is really around the consumption capacity of each individual on the planet and how we manage consumption. Because in 1990, we had 1 billion people in the middle class. And in 2000, in 2010, we're going to have 2 billion. Or we did have 2 billion. In 2030, 5 billion. This massive, and that's a success story if you're one of those people, a huge success story. But how we define that middle class, how we deal with consumption of this many people entering it, that's what puts the pressure on the planetary system. And then us in this room, and this group that we call ourselves, the scientific response to that, what should it look like? Whether you're a naturalist, whether you're an ecologist, whether you're in another discipline, when we think about what's my responsibility in this space? How do I tune my science to be more relevant to this reality? I go back to one paper. I go back to the paper that Jane Buchenco published in 98. And I think this was a seminal piece of work. I've read this probably 10 times, and I read it just last week, and I got as much out of it last week as I did the other 9 times I read it. Maybe I'm just a slow reader, but I think there's actually a lot in this paper about building up the, she was quite early on building up the rhetoric for what the Anthropocene is, and more importantly, how as scientists, the responsibilities we have, the sort of social contract of science with a world of increasing resource scarcity, what in whatever discipline you're in. For us, of course, we translate that into this, what is our social contract? What is our, how can ecology and natural history most effectively embrace 21st century challenges? And I want to chew on that for about 20 or 30 minutes here in this talk. But I first think it's important to do a little definition. I use the following definition for natural history. And, there are a lot of naturalists in this room, and I'm sure we could argue about the definition of natural history for the rest of the 45 minutes. Attention to nature, from the scale of the organism to the scale of the landscape, and the body of honest, accessible work that comes from this attention. Now, the part that I think is most underappreciated and I think most important about this is actually the honesty and accessibility component. These are the words that I don't think we spend enough time thinking about it in natural history or in ecology. Because fundamentally, when one of the things that I think we forget is that the true importance of the truth we gather, the data we gather when we're out in the field, oftentimes is unknown to us when we gather it, oftentimes is unknown to us when we publish on it. And it comes out in someone else's reuse of our data 10, 20, 30, 50 years later. And that can only happen if it's accessible. And our field is not that good at accessibility. It's not that good at reusing our data and making it available to others. That's what creates societal relevance, I think, for natural history. And that's what creates societal relevance for ecology. Ecology, is an ecosystem in itself, right? And that the basic fundamental part, as John was saying, of ecology, that natural history discipline of observation and description at this sort of core part of the pyramid with, comparisons built on observation, built on description, with experimental manipulations on top of that, with theory responding to the results of those experiments and responding to observation and also guiding it. When it works that way, I think ecology is a tremendous tool for finding truth about the natural world. Where it breaks down, I think, is where we start putting this into a hierarchy, where we start thinking that some of these classes of work are more important than others. Because it only works when they're working together. Because theory without observation doesn't get us very far, and observation without organization that theory provides is also not sufficient to the challenges we face. I like Elton's definition of ecology. I like this sort of new name for a very old subject, scientific natural history. But regardless of what you think of these two disciplines and how they relate together, it's a great time to be doing the work. It's a great time to be doing the work because society's paying attention. And they're paying attention whether we're working on energy policy, whether we're working on disease dynamics, whether you're working on food security or water security around the world. And what this means, I think, is that society is asking ecologists and asking naturalists to step up to not only tell us the stories of how the world works, but to predict how the world will work. And that's a scary business because it suggests a predictive version of ecology that demands a lot of information about systems that we don't fully understand today, and we have to make assumptions about in order to make predictions about the future. And that puts us pretty far out on that sort of space in which we're not totally comfortable. It requires a doubling down in the basics of ecology, and it also requires a new, you know, sort of understanding how that social contract works with other disciplines, so we can say more than we do currently. Ultimately, I think society is asking naturalists and asking ecologists to be more predictive, more efficient, and more responsive to the needs of society than we have had to in the past. That's what that lens, that interest is about. And it's about turning our interest in landscapes and in organisms like these into data like these, right? And maps like these and models like these. And whether we're talking about disease dynamics or predicting yields in crops at continental scales or understanding droughts, all of these data sets, all of these models are tremendously data intensive. And they require a lot of detail to be predictive at a scale at which decision makers can use them. Because you have to be able to drill down to the level at which a decision maker works. There are not a lot of decision makers that work at the global scale. There are a lot that work at the country scale. There are a lot that work below that. And so to do that, in ecology, that detail is natural history. And that interface between a deep understanding of the details that allow us to make predictive capacity and the ability to scale that to create results and synthesis that will interact with decision makers is the social relevance of natural history and the social relevance of ecology in the 21st century. And if this is all we had to do, it would still be a heck of a big ask, I think, for a lot of us, for all of us, really, to do this well and to do this consistently. But I also think we're being asked to do more than that, and sometimes I think we fall prey to this idea that ecologists have to be everything. We not only have to be great statisticians and great naturalists and great communicators, we also have to be working on a daily basis with decision makers around the world so that somehow it's our work is not just dropped over the transom, but actually gets used. So it's not enough just to predict disease dynamics. You've got to work with the CDC to do it, or you've got to work with DEFRA or the Agricultural Fund and Research Development to figure out how new crops should be developed in Europe, or work with major industry partners to figure out how to reuse water, or work with investment banks to figure out how to really catalyze wind power. That's the ask that sometimes I feel is this step too far, but it's the ask that society is making on a field because they feel like, here are the experts, you should be working with the decision makers. And that's hard. It's hard because it's a big world and we're a little group. You know, we maybe have 9,000 people in ecology, right? Maybe 25, 30,000 active ecologists, 9,000 people in ESA. 25, 30,000 ecologists active in the world, perhaps. There's about 6-7 million academics in the world. That's one of our tribes, the academic tribe. We're about 70% academic in ESA. We're about 0.5% of academics. We've got another tribe. I think most of us would say we're scientists. That tribe is big too, about the same size as academics, but not all in academia. And one of the things that academics can do is to recognize more consistently that so much good science happens outside of academia and to learn to work and partner more effectively with the science that is going on outside of the academic enterprise as well. That ecosystem will work more effectively when that's happening. So these are our tribes. And you know, together, we want to influence decision makers. So we're down in here in the corner, though. We've got this small group over here, and we're trying to reach these folks. Now, looks like we reached the guy on the right there, because he gave a talk at the beginning, and it looks like he's generally enjoying holding that koala of Tony's. Tony doesn't look like he's enjoying it at all. But the fact is that this is a tremendously hard ask, right? Because those people, even though they look like they're enjoying what they're doing, are not ecologists. And so they don't speak our language. They're not in our tribe. And in fact, even our bigger tribe, academia, is not in this category very often. Here's a sample of academics in yellow as a makeup of the political elite in different countries. Wait, I think there's no yellow down here. There's not a lot of academics in the US system. There are in fact 5 or 6. We heard from one of them in the open plenary. And it's actually, if you take away the other fields, I mean, really the language that's spoken in the US is law and business, right? But if you take away that, the academics are not terribly well represented, and the ecologists aren't represented within the academics in the halls of power. So we have a big leap to get there. And so one of my thesis points is don't try to be everything, but work effectively with others who can make this bridge possible. So I want to sort of break this down and sort of So from here on, the talk takes two bits. First is sort of talking about this collaborative and collective impact that we can have by working with boundary organizations. And the second is linking more ecology and natural history and asking questions about where natural history sits currently within academia and within ecology, and then where it can sit in the future and how it can sort of leverage its impact on the world. So the first part of this is really around boundary organizations. And here's how I would sort of describe what we do currently. We're in natural sciences over here. We feel pretty good when we find an economist to work with. We feel good when we find an earth system scientist to work with. But even that takes a bit of work for most of us. To do it well and to do it consistently is actually time out of our day. And it really does and can reduce our productivity. And then when we do end up working with decision makers, it's a little bit scattershot. Right, it's after that big paper comes out, and you publish the paper, and the news media calls you, and a decision maker reads a report of what came out in the news media and wants to know what to do, and you do the best you can, and that's sometimes how it works if we're doing the direct link. But increasingly, and I think this is a really good thing. There are a lot of other options to make this more consistent and make it more time efficient. And that's working with these boundary organizations. And we do this at multiple scales. I've been doing it at an international scale, trying to really facilitate that. But at local and national scales, there are a lot of other boundary organizations that I won't talk about today. But I recognize that all of this is scale dependent. And by feeding information regularly and working collaboratively with organizations whose job it is to grease the wheels between evidence and decisions, and whose job it is to feed back from decision makers the problems they're having to the discovery communities so that we can work on them, this ecosystem allows us to achieve greater societal relevance as academics, as ecologists, as naturalists. And it's finding your own group. And there's a lot to choose from. So some of these symbols will be, if you can see them from back there, you'll recognize, others you won't. I've sort of arranged them by those that are more natural science oriented, those more social science, by government, non-government. All of these are attempts to link discovery communities, academic communities, and to action communities, whether that's decision makers in the private sector or the public sector, so that there is more evidence reaching the ears that need to make decisions. I'm going to spend just a little time talking through one of them that's relatively new, because I think it's instructive to see just how interdisciplinary these groups think about the problems and then what that says about how we may need to work as an organization to be as effective as possible. So Future Earth is a relatively new organization, but it has old roots and it's founded in earth system dynamics and global change programs around the world. So international global change programs started as a biophysical science initiative to really understand how the planet is put together, how the major flows work within the planet. It then in the late 80s brought on with the International Geosphere Biosphere Program understanding of large-scale biophysical processes. And then again, these communities are there to pull the best scientific evidence and bring it into a scale in which decision makers can use that. And then in the 90s, Diversitas started doing the same thing for biodiversity, really trying to grease the wheels between the impacts of global change on biodiversity and what decision makers could do about those impacts. And by the mid-90s, it was recognized that humans were some part of this problem and that we really needed an international human dimensions program to build to complement this, so that the social sciences had greater access to decision processes. But it wasn't until 10, 15 years ago that the group started working together, really started saying, what we need are different disciplines in science working together on collaborative projects that allow these disciplines to more effectively work as a team. And that's what Sasink is doing today. What Margaret talked about that. And there are a lot of different groups doing this at different scales. And Future Earth is really trying to do that at a global scale. So I'm not going to go through too much of what it does, but I wanted to sort of give you an idea of the type of questions or challenges it's set for itself. Because these aren't that different than the challenges you'll see by major conservation organizations. And I see them as targets for research, targets that I would like my research to be a part of so that it can have impact. So I think I got to go here. So these are major focal challenges that Future Earth came up with a lengthy stakeholder engagement process to understand what are the big problems that people see around the world. And they're not so different than a list you would come up with, I'm sure. Food, energy, and water, climate change, natural assets and ecosystem services, how do we build resilient cities, viable rural futures, sustainable consumption and production, human health, risk management. That's an 80% overlap with what major NGOs are coming up with around the world for their major goal sets. The question on how, but when you see like how an organization that's specifically in the boundary of linking discovery communities to action communities, how it frames its questions, they're international, interdisciplinary, and transdisciplinary. So they're things like deliver water, energy, and food for all and manage synergies and trade-offs among them by understanding how these interactions are shaped by environmental, economic, social, and political changes. That's just a huge whopper. Like, you know, where you fit into that as an ecologist is really hard to see. But that ecology is critical to doing that is crystal clear. And that, I think, is the challenge, right? We know our discipline is fundamental to solving these big societal challenges. But how it fits in and how to make our particular science fit in effectively, that's the challenge that we face. So one of the things that I wanted to do is to ask a little bit about how we're doing on this idea of being international, about being interdisciplinary, about being transdisciplinary, both as ecologists and natural historians, or naturalists. So I did a little teaming up with Elsevier and their Scopus data team to sort of ask basic questions about literature in our field. And so I'm just going to walk through this slide really quickly. The other ones will be sort of similar. So Scopus is a data set of about 50 million citations and 21,000 published journals, all in the sort of the peer-reviewed literature space. And what they're and they're fully itemized so that what we're seeing here is all papers in 2009 with international collaborations. And what that just basically means, each one of these dots is a flag of a country. That's the affiliation of the lead author. That's all it means. And this basically says that in China, about 20%, a little less, of all papers published with Chinese first authors also had a co-author from another country. That's all it says. If they were in ecology, that number was about 25%. And the fact that all of these dots are above the line basically says that in relation to other fields, ecology is more international than most other fields in sciences. We more often work across borders than other fields do. And I think that's a good thing, and actually it's increasing through time. And it's also a good thing if you want to get cited, as it turns out. Because if you look at the same data set and ask, and these are citation impact, so this is individual paper level, you are more likely to get cited if you have an international collaborator on your paper than not. Now, the interesting part about this is that if you're a Chinese team, if we think about this, it makes sense. And it makes sense that some dots are further from the line than others, right? Because so much of the academic disciplines are in Western countries now, but there's this major increase in both quality and quantity of Chinese science, for example. Those papers that are coming out of China with an international collaborator are accessing a much bigger social network, and so they're much more likely to be published, more likely to be cited. And so China gets a big bump, the U.S. a smaller bump, but all these countries still gain by being international. So we're following our incentive structures, which is good in this case. But not all incentive, oops, sorry, I forgot to tell you that I also did it in 2013. So this is 2009, these are the same relationships in 2013. Now, you know, some countries are moving faster in citation impact, some countries are moving slower, but everyone is staying sort of above that line. Meaning that international collaborations are good for citation, and we're becoming more international as a field. Okay, not so when you talk about interdisciplinary research. So another thing we can do with the same data set is just simply ask, what are the most interdisciplinary papers that are published across all of these citations? And the way that Scopus does that is we look at the citations that are in a paper and say, how many of those citations come from other fields? And a very interdisciplinary paper would have a lot of citations from other fields. If we rank all these millions of papers that way and take the top 10%, those are the most interdisciplinary papers across all of sciences. What's the share? How often does an ecology paper get into that top 10% chunk? And the answer is not very often compared to papers in other fields, which means we tend to cite other ecology. We're a little bit less interdisciplinary than some other fields. Now, that can be a good or a bad thing, but it's worth being aware of. And it also, it's interesting because it actually follows our incentive structures. Because it turns out this is all ecology over here, that we're all these countries are below the line. And it doesn't matter where you're from. If you publish a really interdisciplinary paper in ecology, you're a little less likely to get cited. And so that, again, is following some incentive structures. And this, I would say, is not a good thing for ecology's relevance. I'll leave it at that. I think that's probably not a positive incentive structure for us. Okay, so that deals with interdisciplinarity and the internationalization of ecology. I was very interested in understanding also transdisciplinary nature. Like, what is the evidence that actually gets into the conservation literature, that makes up the recommendations that major boundary organizations, that major NGOs, the UN uses to sort of state the facts about the state of the world and state the facts about what we should be doing about the state of the world? Because their megaphone for this is much greater than ours, and they are much more connected to decision makers. And so what is it that gets into that literature? So when at the Luke Hoffman Institute, we went through about 315 different reports in 9 series, all the major state of the world reports for all the big NGOs, the UN, et cetera, and asked, where does the evidence come from? So, you know, I had 3 questions. How much of it comes from the peer-reviewed literature? And then what type of peer-reviewed literature actually makes it into this work? How well does ecology do? So the first thing we find is that most of the citations in the major NGO state of the world reports are not from the peer-reviewed literature at all. And so, you know, as someone who really believes that one of the things that science as a culture provides to the rest of the world is this check on our ability to just shout out and say whatever we want, we have to get through some level of peer review. That fundamental sort of capacity to insert that into these major reports is limited, right? We're not that much of the evidence being used to support claims about the nature of the world and what we should do about it is coming from the peer-reviewed literature. And it varies a lot by reports, about 19% on average if you include all of them. If you remove the IUCN Environmental Law Report, which is a bit of a different culture, you get to 25% of the citations being peer-reviewed on average. The reason I think this is also important is because at the Luke Hoffman Institute, one of the things that I noticed in the major NGOs was a reliance on strong fast reaction time consultancies, for example, that academics sometimes have a hard time competing with. And so the question then becomes, to what extent are these communities creating alternative universes of information? And we haven't really answered that question with this because we don't know to what extent these non-peer-reviewed citations actually trace back to a peer-reviewed citation at the back. And so there's more work to be done. But if you ask the question of what journals get published, not surprisingly, if you create a journal to target the audience that I was studying, you end up being successful. Conservation Biology and Biological Conservation are the most cited journals in all of the NGO reports by a long shot, followed by Nature and Science. And on this axis is just the number of citations. That's the number of different reports they appear in. What I think is interesting here is beyond those obvious journals, ecology journals make up a large fraction of the peer-reviewed citations in the NGO literature. So ecology is a dominant field already. But this is a relatively coarse way of looking at the data, and I want to flip it, because we went through and looked at how all the journals describe themselves based on Crossref, which you have to have a subject field. And if you look at the subject fields and which subject fields are getting into the evidence base for conservation organizations, it looks like this. It looks like ecology. It looks dominance of ecology in these fields. And so really it's like 10 to 1 in terms of citations that come from ecology journals versus citations that come from social science journals. As an ecologist, that looks like a success story. As a conservationist who recognizes that a lot of the problems are around people and how people make decisions, I'm not so sure that's a success story. But understanding, you know, but in some senses, we do have a literature and a history that we're being very successful in ecology entering this field in compared to other disciplines. I'm just going to say one more thing about this before I move on, which is that, you know, when measuring international collaborations or interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary work, citations are a rough tool, and they're only one way of doing it. And yeah, they're broad in scope, and there's a lot of data there, but it's not really where the rubber meets the road for most of us. And for most of us, the decision processes in which our work, our knowledge, reaches decision processes are personal connections. And the social networks we form, and our ability to link outside of just our own community to other communities that are making decisions. And that was a lot of what we did at the Luke Hoffman Institute. And I'm just going to show a couple slides of sort of how that makes a difference for when I was doing it. And to make this point, working with ETH in Zurich and EPFL, which are two big Swiss academic institutions, we submitted a grant that was to the Swiss National Science Foundation that basically said, we want to work on palm oil. We want to work on palm oil and understand the ecological, economic, and social implications of this crop around the world. We want to do it in Indonesia, in Congo, and in Colombia. But we don't have any idea what science to do. Can you give us $2 or $3 million to figure that out? And they did. And I think that was, to me, a complete shock. And I think it's really hard, but that's a different kind of science, right? Because the reality is, if you want to work with stakeholders and figure out what's needed, you have to be honest about what you know. And if you haven't first flown around the world to bring all those stakeholders together, you don't know which science is needed yet. And so the first thing we did when we got that grant was to bring those stakeholders together from civil society on three different continents, from academics from three different continents, you know, and in a facilitated workshop, figure out what are the issues in the different locations. And of course, when you do that, you find out that solutions are not about one-size-fits-all solutions, that problems are not palm oil problems. They're palm oil in Indonesia problems, which are completely different than palm oil problems in Colombia, for example. And so that kind of a process and building up from the needs of the stakeholders to create the science is laborious. It doesn't get you publications as fast. But it's also working directly, co-creating with the partners that will use those publications when they're completed. So I think this kind of a model is something that we do need to see more of. And I do see that, again, you see that outside of some of the major science foundations, but it's neat to see the science foundations around the world starting to support it as well. Okay, so I talked a lot about sort of how we're going from these big challenges and want to get to these solutions and how big of an ask that is. And I don't think the word that goes in the center here is science, really. But I do think the word that goes in the center is service, right? And science is a part of service. You know, if we think of our discipline as a service to society, we fit in with providing information, you know, building collaborations, pushing innovation, working with education, and engaging around the world. And a science that is seen as science of service is much more transdisciplinary, user-focused, co-created, solution-oriented, and scalable than we're used to in the past, right? And we see all sorts of evidence that that's the direction we're moving. So the last thing I wanted to sort of reiterate, which I touched on a little bit in the example about palm oil, is that very few of the conservation issues we're working with, the big ones, have silver bullet solutions. Maybe none of them, right? All of this is about silver buckshot. It's about locating a solution that works in one place at one time with one community. Because it's not as if once you find the ecological solution in community and ecosystem A with economics A, transferring that to even a similar ecology in another location changes the economics, changes the social structure. The solution is likely to be different. Not because the ecology is different, but because the complex system in which it's embedded is, of course, different. So silver buckshot is something that I'm a huge champion of at this point. And that requires getting our buckshot out of our own discipline and to decision makers. Okay, so I'm going to focus now a little bit more on what I think is the power of natural history in ecology to give us those solutions more rapidly and effectively. So I love this slide because these are all paper titles, basically just saying that natural history is going extinct. And there's been a cottage industry about writing about natural history going extinct for about 100 years now. And you know, and that was before we even started the natural history section. And so, it's not going extinct, of course, but it is changing. And it's changing the way, I think, and the nature of natural history is changing through time. It's no longer as much about the individual naturalist doing fantastic work. It's more about the collection of the community of natural history that we do together. When a group of us set out to sort of understand, to sort of look at these titles and go, well, let's put some data to it, to say, is natural history declining? Is it going extinct? We did a couple things. We looked through all of the course catalogs we looked through a lot of course catalogs for about 30 different institutions from about a 40-year span to say, how much natural history do you need to get a BS in biology in the US? And is that changing through time? And, you know, not surprisingly, It is changing. So exposure to natural history is declining, at least in undergraduate serving institutions. You now need a mode of under one natural history course to get a BS of biology in the US. You used to need two or three. So you don't have to get a lot of natural history to be a biologist now. That could be a good or a bad thing. If you're a molecular biologist and you just want to get on to medical school, it's probably a good thing for you, or at least you perceive it as a good thing. If you're a natural historian or an ecologist, you might not see it that way. It's also true that in textbooks, we looked at textbooks from 1930 to 2011 and tried to understand how they're changing through time. And what you see in textbooks is what you see in, it mirrors the trend in course requirements. And those also decline through time. This is the percentage of each textbook devoted to things like ecology, evolution, anatomy, physiology through time. They're declining. They went from about 60 to 65% focused on that in the 60s to about 35% currently. Now, that's the dawn of the molecular biology. It's not that's the massive expansion of our field and the room that is created for that field in the textbooks. You know, in 1916, David Starr Jordan said, you know, natural history is the beginning and the end of biological study. And it largely was in 1916, but it really isn't today. There's a lot more to our field. So that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does mean that exposure on a relative sense is declining for in an educational sense. And one more place we looked, we were really trying to look at exposure through museums as well. How is access to museums changing through time globally? Can we see trends in that? There's not one global database of museums around the world that are natural history oriented that I could find. But there was one for herbaria that Barbara Theres keeps for us at the New York Botanical Garden. And what you look at there is, if you look at the data of the censuses of herbaria around the room, you see a lot of contraction, a lot of consolidation of our specimens. And that's good if you're someone who really needs to access a lot of specimens. You fly to one place and there's tons of specimens right there. But it's not so good if you're a student who might get your hook into natural history by getting into the back room of an herbaria in, you know, in your town or in your city, because it doesn't exist there anymore necessarily. So we're only adding about two herbaria per year globally at this point. We were adding 30 or 40 in the 70s. And then in the US and Europe, we're actually seeing declines in the number of herbaria around the country and around the European continent. They're being consolidated. There's not a good business model for keeping them for many universities. So access, I think, is also declining. And that really is not the death of natural history, but it does require a response. It requires us to sort of think of new measures by which we advance natural history in society and question the role of the professional naturalist and how it relates to the role of the amateur naturalist. Because it was at one point mostly amateur naturalists. We've professionalized that discipline, and yet there are a ton of amateur naturalists around the world still participating. So taking advantage of technology and taking advantage of really mobilizing amateur naturalists is, I think, a key bit of where we're going in the future. I'm going to talk just a bit about that first bit, the collaboration and curation, which is, you know, one thing we're doing in ecology that's super exciting, I think, for a lot of us, is that ground-up collaborative process in which we take groups of investigators, whether it's the Nutrient Network or Gloria or the 50 hectare plots, and we work together with common protocols to understand a broad global problem. And that's, to me, where ecology is finally coming together as a community of ecologists to work as that community, to standardize some of how we do things so that we can have greater impact, so we can leverage our leverage our results. It's not as much fun as using your own tape measure and figuring it out your own way. And I spent 15 years doing exactly that, figuring out my own way with chilies, and I loved it. But if you want to leverage the impact globally, you need data sets that speak globally or speak to decision makers at the scale at which they work. And these projects, and as well as NEON is really wanting to do that as well from a different approach, speak to the changes in ecology and how they do that. And a lot of this work, I think, really is Elton's version of ecology. It's natural history with scientific dressing, right? It's the 50 hectare plots are a lot of natural history gathering that information and a little bit of design, really critical design, and a little bit of really critical statistics. So recently, a group of grad students at University of Washington, I was privileged enough to work with them on sort of trying to understand how citizen science and citizen science and biodiversity was changing through time and the opportunities that it presented. And one of the things that we did early on was sort of look at Well, interest in biodiversity through time. And I threw on here interest in natural history through time. It's that black line down here. This is the number of papers as a percentage of total papers in Web of Science. And it doesn't change very much through time, and it's not very large. Biodiversity, of course, is increasing through time. This is, again, published papers in the peer-reviewed literature. All the other global climate change subjects increasing through time. This is citizen science initiation. We're initiating citizen science projects at a faster rate of increase than we're increasing literature in any of the global change topics. So there's this huge public push to get involved in the science process and to get involved in the biodiversity science process. And many people in this room are already involved in those processes. So it's growing fast. And I want to just say a couple things about the nature of it that I found surprising. It's much deeper than I first appreciated. You know, citizen science takes us in all sorts of directions, and technology allows us to take it much deeper than birds. Yes, we're oversampling vertebrates because people love to study vertebrates. Yes, we're undersampling insects. So are we as professionals. So that's not too surprising. So we see a broad and wide swath of natural history data collection being happening through citizen science. And what I think about it as a revolution for ecology and natural history is the scaling of it, right? So this is just simply current participants, log scale and spatial extent. And a huge number of programs are out here in this fine scale, a fine grain, broad extent, where we could never hope to touch as individual scientists. We couldn't pay enough people to do that. But you can through citizen science programs, collecting that kind of data. It's also, you know, a lot of investment is going into it at this point. And the last thing is longevity. We heard about, you know, a long program in ecology being one that outlasted your NSF grant. And I think, you know, for a lot of us that it is a challenge to maintain 5, 10, 15, 20-year data sets. And in citizen science programs, a lot of them are doing that. They're doing that right now, right? With many of them 25 years and older, and many of the participants actually collecting the data, they will keep at it for year after year after year, particularly if they're asked to do things in a consistent way. So here is essentially, we surveyed a whole bunch of programs, and here is essentially, if you know, programs that ask participants to sample things 1 to 4 times a year or 6 to 12 times a year, like a monthly survey is here, a good percentage of their participants would stay 4 years or more. That's the brown bars here. If you don't tell people what to do very often, or if you tell them to do too much, people quit more often. But you know, compare that to, you know, a field tech and how many times you're able to hire the same field tech in a row. 4 years is fantastic. And it represents a level of consistency that's really hard to match. And we're getting better at understanding how to do that. So this speaks to me about how we use our talents as professional naturalists to work with amateur naturalists around the world to leverage what we want to do for natural history. I think people in this room are really well placed to lead this effort. And one thing that we find is that it's not up here, but most of the citizen science, you know, programs around the world aren't publishing in the peer-reviewed literature. But if you start one with an academic as the lead, guess what? The incentive structure aligns great. And then you start publishing. And when it is published, then you expose yourself to peer review and you get better. So by using the best of the scientific processes and integrating it with the best of the citizen science programs, I think we have a really strong value add. I'm going to end with just a little bit on transparency in technology. And I spoke about this at the beginning. And this is where I think one of the ironies of the work that we did is that the vast majority of the citizen science programs we looked into, hundreds of them, like the data is accessible. It's just not published very much. And if you actually do the same kind of sort of survey of peer-reviewed literature in ecology, and I did this with Stephanie Hampton and some other folks at NCES, when we just walked through and took 5 years of NSF grants, randomly select papers from each one of those grants, and then asked, can you get to the data behind that paper? Right? So recent grants, all federally supported, papers from those recent grants, the reasonable effort to try and find the data, can you do it? Well, in 60% of the cases almost, you can't. Right? Lots and lots of dark data in our field. Lots of data that will never get reused because it can't be accessed. And most of the data sharing that goes on in these random sample of papers is in things like GenBank and Treebase, right? In communities that have already shifted to a culture in which data sharing is the norm. Most of ecology hasn't made that shift yet. And it's not as if there aren't places to share our data. It's out there, right? We've got things like Dryad, we've got Data One, Database, and KNB, lots of different options for putting data. Not a lot of incentives to do the work to get it up there. Not a lot of positive incentives, not a lot of sticks, not a lot of carrots, period, right? We can do what we want with our data, and I think that actually reduces our capacity to influence change as ecologists and as naturalists. So getting out of this long tail of dark data in ecology probably requires more transparency and collaboration within and across disciplines, and you know, changes that are happening in incentive structures to reward the collection and the sharing and curation of natural history and ecology data, and really a flattening of ecology. More amateur naturalists, more treating natural history as civics, as part of what we do as protectors of the planet, not something we do as professionals necessarily, but just part of what we do to get information out to the world, in a world that we're trying to really preserve, you know, for the next generation of naturalists, wherever they are, however they start. That, I think, is sort of what we're about in some ways. I want to thank just a few folks that have helped with this that are not on this list. The natural history section has been a home for me and a fantastic group to be involved with. And ESA really still is very much my tribe, even though I've been wandering far from home of late. So thanks so much for your attention. Someone's got to start. Yes, thank you. I had to ask myself a question if you hadn't done that. So part of it, I think, is cultural. Part of it, I think, is baked into how we train the next generation of ecologists and what we value in how we train them. And I think, you know, as we work more towards thinking about data curation as a part of what it means to be a professional ecologist, no one had classes or even informal lectures on that when I was going to school, and very few of us do even now. That's an essential change that we have to go through to enter this sort of more responsive component, right? So we're actively looking for that data. But on the other side, central repositories that make it easier to find and standardization is a huge problem in ecology, naturally so. I mean, we've tried to solve this for 100 years or more, and it's really hard to do because we all have a different idea on how to measure and what we're measuring and how to go after what we're doing. That's a function of small science. I mean, really, when you can do things with a tape measure, you don't have to talk to anyone about how to do them. But when you start having to do them with more complicated tools that you have to share, you have to have those conversations. And as those conversations bubble up into networks, like the Nutrient Network and other places, that networking becomes more exposed and more and then you can see that data popping up in more places. So the degree to which we can spend time connecting our data and incentivize that and provide resources for that, I estimated what it would cost to do that with my lab after 15 years. It was about $30,000 of man hours just to get the data I've collected out of file cabinets and online. And I didn't have just $30,000 kicking around to do that. So it's still not online yet, right? And there are programs at NSF devoted to doing just that. But more on that on the federal level, more, and that is a monetary solution. But we have to think about a little bit where the money is best spent. Like where do, you know, to what extent do we want to let the data we've already collected not get out, in the search for the next bit of data. And I think we do that at a very basic level in our labs, and in whether it's a federal lab or an academic lab, and we do that at a larger institutional sort of levels when we're always looking for that next cool silver thing to look at, and oh, that's no longer cool anymore. Whatever happened to that, we're off over here. And this doesn't get the attention so that it can come back and be useful. And the only culture that's really good at that within ecology is the museum culture. Like, a lot to learn from the museum culture and where they're moving and how they're putting it together. Well, and the genetics is also quite, you know, molecular culture is also quite good at that, I should say. Yeah.
Yeah, so you described a decline in
Yeah.
And so that's probably associated with the decline in the number of experts teaching those courses.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
So do you have a solution or a way we can move forward in that way, inspiring?
Yeah. That's why the natural history section, I think, is so important, because I think what you need in an academic enterprise is a scaffolding to reward excellence in a discipline. We don't have that in natural history. We don't have the academic scaffolding through which reward structures can be sort of inserted. So we don't have enough rewards that will speak to tenure committees. And because we have awards for the best young ecologist and they're well recognized, those count towards tenure. Because we have, you know, specific talks and titles. I mean, there used to be 50 endowed professors of natural history in this country. There are now maybe 3 or 4. Because we don't see that as a critical part. But you know, when we claim that as senior professors, we institutionalize its value for more junior people along the line. So I think it is really up to those people who have the freedom to call themselves whatever they want. And if you have tenure, it's kind of amazing what you can get away with that way. So I think it's worth doing it, because it makes a difference to those people who are trying to establish themselves in the field and want to figure out where they can find a home. So I think there is some of that, creating that ladder, and that's also about publication, is figuring out how to, one of the great trends that I think will help is our valuing of data sets as data sets. Because when the data is as valuable as your interpretation of the data, natural history has a bigger say in the scientific discourse. And it is as valuable, and we've proved that over and over again through the use and reuse and reuse of museum specimens for more and more subject matters. So to the extent that ecology and professors in ecology can encourage their students to not stop at just the first paper, but to publish the data set, and you start institutionalizing that. And guess what? If you're a tenure committee and you see a publication in ecology and then another publication of ecology that's actually publication of a data set, but you're in physiology, you don't know the difference, and you think those are two papers in ecology. And that's how it should be, because they are two papers in ecology. So we have to get to that point in which we're not saying, oh, that's just data. Like, just data, that's 95% of the work. And it may be the most important part. Yeah. Yes? Yeah, the short answer is tremendously hard to find a business model for. Biological field stations are a huge resource, and most universities that run them have a hard time figuring out how to keep them running. And it's, in some ways, I'd say it's close to a crisis state, because there's very few of them. The resources they provide are these exceptionally rich spaces that really so many practicing ecologists can trace their time back to these places as the sort of foundation of when they've decided to become an ecologist. But that never gets counted in the academic budgeting of how many students you've served. And it turns out that it's really expensive. You work with fewer students more intensively in biological field stations, and you don't run 800-person classes, right? You run 8-person classes or 18-person classes. And under current academic constraints, that's really hard to justify. So I think they're critical, and I think the way in which they get saved is by organizing within universities across departments and getting them directly up into recognizing that a university has to claim them for what they are, not ask them to compete with academic departments. Because they'll always lose in that competition. They don't do the same thing. They're not another department at your university. They are an essential resource that the provost and the president and the development team have to treasure for what it does for the community. And you actually have to run them a little bit like that, which means you can't be so proud of your academic achievements, and you also have to reach out to the public from your field stations to bring those people in as part of your key donor base. So new models are required. Yeah. Doug.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. The question is, because so much of decisions at federal agencies are based on merit review, we often, how do you judge the quality of natural history studies in a merit review process fairly? And so that we understand what a good natural history study is versus one that I guess is mediocre. You're within the context. So I think I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that the answer to that is actually contained in some of the sort of future of natural history, which is that, you know, for a federal agency, I think you have to be concerned with the scale of your constituency. And so natural history in the 21st century has to be done smart. We don't have the luxury of funding my passion for nematodes. My passion. If that passion for nematodes is shared with 1,000 people across the US and we can collect it at scale, that's not a luxury anymore, right? That's a part of understanding how nematodes interact with ecosystems at the scale at which decision makers will use that information. And so I think the strategy for those proposing and for NSF has to be around the use factor, around how does this basic information serve society? And the arguments have to be made around that use, around the potential use of this information at scale, which means that we can't, as individual investigators, think of natural history as a right. But we do have to compete for our ability to collect the basic information that society needs to make decisions. Like, I don't think you can get out of that bit. So we have, in other words, I guess what I'm saying is, it's not as much, I don't know that you can create a special category for natural history and then scale and then, you know, have that bin. I don't think that quite works. Yeah.
Can I follow up?
Yes, I thought you were. Yes.
I thought you asked this question about intellectual merit and you answered about broader impact.
Oh, interesting.
Oh. And I thought that was really telling.
Okay, good. Good. So that's a great discussion point. Absolutely, I think you're absolutely right. And I've been in the broader impact space for 2.5 years, so that's right. We have, at least at NSF, correct me if I'm wrong here, there is this sort of space in which broader impact and intellectual merit are up to the panel to decide on how much weight to give to each. My guess is that there's a pattern to how panels come down on that. And that's a cultural bit. And so to the extent that, and there's, I think, a valid question about how we should be cutting that. Because too much on broader impacts as we currently define them could squelch some of the most interesting and exciting proposals coming out of basic sciences. On the other hand, it might be worth trying to figure out whether different branches of science or different types of science deserve attention, or whether the same system for all science is appropriate. In other words, is it really fair to say all panels should just decide and we're all going to use the same system? Or is there a balance within the federal system between information that is core and information that is what would you call the intellectual merit bit? Sometimes I guess I would call it exciting. Or something like that, or in the room. I don't have a good answer yet. I'm going to work on it. Clearly, I don't have a good answer. Any other answers I can answer? Yes, in the back.
I was curious about your slide that had the boundary organization in the middle.
Yeah.
You had two parts. One was basically making information
that's
coming out of science.
Oh, that one. Yeah, my bow tie. I call it my. Oops, sorry, wrong way. Yeah, go ahead. Keep going, I'm getting there.
And I'm actually pretty interested in the other side.
Yeah.
How do you understand what questions are really needed or the most challenging conservation?
Yeah, there you are. Yeah. So.
Right, so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more.
Well, and there's a tremendous opportunity for this if we could get our act together. One thing that I would love to set up at a very fundamental level that I think would help with the process is is essentially a clearinghouse or a dating service between needs communities and communities that are looking for topics to be interested in. And it wouldn't be that hard to establish or even be that expensive. So one of the things that I found at the Lou Coffin Institute was there's tons of programs in WWF wanting to know things like, I just want to know where the bearded pigs are. Well, at the Lou Coffin Institute, I can't fund that. That's not what I'm there to do. But I know there are about 7 graduate students just starting somewhere in the world who want to find those bearded pigs. But they don't know the people in WWF who want that information. And so part of it is just using technology in a smart way to close the gap between the needs communities and the communities of people who are filtering through subjects to figure out what to do with their career. And it's catching people early. The assistant professors are useless in this space. They're not fast enough. And they all have their own agenda. But the beginning grad student is exactly where you want to catch people. And really the kind of information you need is right there. It's at that space where you can establish a relationship. It's not that hard to do. I'm hoping that someone picks it up and does it. Yeah. Dan.
Josh, great talk. Thank you.
Thanks.
I wanted to ask you about the analysis of the multiple environmental reports.
Yeah.
IUCN, World Health.
Yeah.
I found your results fairly shocking.
Really? Yep.
Where are the conclusions of these major reports coming from if they're not founded primarily on what we know from the subject of did you look at where the other inputs?
Yeah, so this is the second space. So it's very easy to show that most of the evidence doesn't come from the peer-reviewed literature. It's much harder to understand what percentage of those claims don't trace back to the peer-reviewed literature. And that's what you really want to know. Like, to what extent is this an alternative universe of information? And to what extent is it just easier to cite a synthesis report done by IUCN that itself cites the peer-reviewed literature, right? Doing that well, we want to sample the data and actually ask, like, take random non-peer-reviewed citations in this database and then ask to what extent you can trace those claims back to the peer-reviewed literature. But it's a lot more laborious process than we had at first envisioned. Yeah. Oh, sure. Sorry. Informal stakeholder interviews throughout the last 2.5 years suggest a lot, but no. I didn't do them informally with it in relation to this project. It's a really good idea to do. It's huge. Personal networks are so important in the NGO field because time constraints are so much more important. So if your data comes in late, it's just useless. And if I can work with someone who I know can get me the information on time, that's gold. And that's rarely an academic. Our schedules just don't fit well in that space. Yeah, Cliff. Right. So the same thing we do. We talk to each other. That's what they do. It's not surprising. We're social animals. Yeah. I think we're getting close. Oh, yeah. One more. Sure.
Okay. Thank you very much for your inspiring presentation. What's interesting thing is to see your slide showing that the portion of academia in the politicians saying that Egypt is more than 20%. I'm from South Korea. South Korea seems to be more than 10%. But in U.S., it's only what, near 0%.
To
me. So we can mean that academia is more influential to society or politics, or
it's great.
Perfectly weak in the influence.
Yeah, I mean, it turns out that. Yeah, the question is sort of, was speaking of the different academic influences across different societies. I was just looking at the politics, the tribe backgrounds of politicians in different countries. And yeah, it's very different across different countries. And it does make a difference. Like, for example, China also has a lot of politicians that have former academic backgrounds. And the access and the impact of Chinese academics, the top tier there, is tremendous. And it makes working with China as an NGO much easier than working with the US. Because you just don't have any access. Like, you can talk to any academics as long as you want in the US, and it's not going to influence policy very fast. But in China, that's not necessarily true. So, you know, the river policy is a direct product of a few academics that were well placed there, and their academic backgrounds, they got it. You know, their environment minister, they totally get the idea of free-flowing rivers. They implemented it in no time. Not easy to, so yeah, it does make a difference. I can't comment on the cultural roots of all of it. I know that in the US, we used to, most of our politicians used to be veterinarians way back in the day, but no longer the case. But that's not really answering your question. I think I'm cognizant of time. I'm happy to take more questions, but I don't know when we're out, so I don't have a clock up here.
Why don't we end it there?
Okay.
Stay up here.
Yeah.